Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema. Hello everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale and today I have the pleasure of talking to Neil Alcock, who has written a wonderful book on Alfred Hitchcock called Hitchology. If you enjoyed the episode, please remember to share, like, subscribe if you haven't done already, and make sure we can enlarge our audience to Hitchcockian levels. But before you do any of that, enjoy the conversation. That you sort of say at the very beginning of the book, you know, you don't have to read all the way through this book. There's a sort of guide to reading the book because you might want to sort of go and watch a film, then come back to the book and sort of read the thing or read it. You know, there are various ways. So I thought, oh, brilliant, bingo. I can read the introduction and then pick a few films and sort of get a feel for it. I don't have to read it cover to cover. But of course, I start reading it from the beginning and you know, it just gets whizzing through it.
Okay, that's good.
Occasionally skipping a film that I think, okay, wait a second, I haven't seen this, so I want to be...
Fine.
I maybe come back to it later. So, I mean, congratulations on that. It's got a real readability that it's very difficult to stop once you begin.
Oh, that's good to know. Thank you very much. Yeah, that was the intention. I just wanted people to, like I say in the book, I just wanted people to be able to dip in if they wanted to. But I think if you do read it from start to finish, you do get a sense of a story, of Hitchcock's story, his kind of development of his career and his skills throughout all the films he made. I think it kind of works in both ways.
There is a real biography in there, not only in terms of watching him make his films, but also his films themselves. You know, when you talk about Rebecca, you're saying, well, in a way, Joan Fontaine's character is a bit like Hitchcock in a new environment, a little bit scared, not sure what she's doing there, and the anxiety of influence of all the people who've been before.
Yeah, he crops up in a lot of his own films, and I think half the time he knows full well that he's doing it, and sometimes maybe he doesn't, and the film says some stuff about him that he maybe wasn't intending to reveal. But I think that's really interesting.
What was your first sort of encounter with Hitchcock?
Well, I had always kind of been into film since I was a kid, although for a long time it was just basically watching films on the telly with my dad. Bond films became the thing that kind of really dragged me into trying out other films. And so by the time I got to... So I studied... history, geography, and economics at A level, and I did really, really badly in all of them. So I retook A levels at a different college where I was able to do film studies. And I thought, well, great, I like films, that's cool. And one of the teachers there showed us Vertigo. And in actual fact, I was off that day. I think I was off sick, but he lent me the VHS tape. It was that long ago. He lent me the VHS tape to take home and watch. So I watched Vertigo at home. That was my first kind of full experience of a Hitchcock film. I think I'd probably seen clips of Psycho before that. But yeah, I was just blown away by this film because it was just so weird. It was like nothing else I'd ever seen before. It was a great mystery. It was really beautiful, but there was something really strange and indefinable about it. And I just couldn't wait to get back to college and talk about it and find out what other people were saying about it and thinking about it. And it's just gone on from there. From that point onwards, I just wanted to watch everything that he did.
Yeah, I remember watching Psycho at the very, a friend of mine, I think it's always important to have these sort of slightly older figures in your life. Like, you know, it was a friend of my brother's who was like 2 years older than me. And he'd say, oh, you got to watch this, you got to watch this. And he put on a video of Psycho. And I'd never seen it. And I was like, I must have been like...
Were you like four?
It wasn't far off. I mean, it goes a bit mushy, but I remember just not knowing what the twist was and not knowing about the shower and just being totally blown away by it and amazed by it.
I'm so envious of people now who haven't seen Psycho, who are into films and they're interested, but they just, for some what reason, one reason or another, they just haven't seen that film. To imagine now being a film fan and seeing that for the first time, it's just amazing.
But there was a recent Twitter debate about, like, someone, you know, someone was talking about teaching a film class and saying nobody's seen The Matrix, you know, that's where the cultural amnesia starts, you know, the late 90s. And there's always this sort of hoo-ha about how bad that is. But then again, there's another bit of me that thinks that means they can watch Psycho and Vertigo and be like babes, you know, in the woods.
It's, you know, I kind of welcome the onset of my fading memory where I can watch all these films again and they'll be brand new.
So you did film studies at A level. Did you continue sort of academically in that direction?
Yeah, I did film, TV and radio studies at Staffordshire University, which was a lot more theoretical than practical. I kind of had dreams of going into the film industry in some way, maybe to be a cameraman or something, but that didn't quite work out. But, you know, I just discovered a real passion for just investigating films a bit more, not just kind of watching them and then moving on to the next one, but kind of really thinking about them and thinking about what other, you know, finding out what other people were saying about them, because there's always something that you spot in a film that you can't quite explain. And so to go away and read other stuff about it is just opens your mind to all these other possibilities. And you don't have to agree with them, but they just make you, sometimes they just make you think of other things that you hadn't thought of. So, you know, it's just a whole kind of world of possibility and interpretation there.
And how did you start writing about film then? How did you make that?
That was a thing that I tried to do when I was at university. I wrote film reviews of things that I was seeing at the time, and I sent a few off to Empire Magazine and Total Film, but got absolutely nowhere because they were terrible. I've still got them somewhere on a hard drive somewhere, and I look at them every now and again and just cringe. They're really awful. But I think that probably put me off for a very, very long time. And then, I don't know, maybe 20 years, 25 years even after that, I was just, you know, thinking about these things that we've just been talking about investigating film a bit further. And I didn't really have a circle of friends that I could do that with. My friends didn't really seem particularly interested in doing that. So I started a blog in 2009 called The Incredible Suit, which was just going to be an outlet for me to just write these things down. And that just, it kind of just went on from there, really. I just started, you know, it was incredibly facetious and puerile and silly. But as the years went on and I just kept writing more stuff on there, and nobody was really reading it, it never really got a particularly big readership. But I just kind of, without really realizing it, honed my writing skills and realized after a while that I was actually getting a little bit better as a writer.
Thank God for very small readerships.
Yeah, right. You can really practice and make a total bodge of it with nobody paying any attention. But yeah, that was good. And I ended up going to a few events. And I think the defining one was probably the Empire. I think it was called the Big Screen Experience. It was at the O2. And I met Nick Desemelin there, who is now the editor, and Chris Hewitt, who anybody interested in film will know those names. And just kind of, you know, got to know them a little bit, and we started following each other on Twitter, and they started reading the blog. And then eventually I plucked up the courage to say, look, is there any chance I could do something for Empire? And they said, yeah, sure. So they gave me like little, very small things to do, like tiny little DVD reviews. And then that, you know, kind of snowballed from there. I ended up, I think the peak of my Empire years was going onto the set of Spectre, which as a Bond fan is about the most unbelievable dream you could achieve. So that was very exciting. And I think the favorite thing that I do for Empire is a thing that they have at the back of the magazine called a masterpiece, where a writer chooses a film. And if Chris Hewitt says, yes, I want that film in my magazine, you can write 1,000 words on that film, basically, whatever you think, as long as it justifies that film as a masterpiece. And I've done about half a dozen of these over the last few years. And that is really what kind of informed Hitchology a little bit, because I realized that if you limit yourself to 1,000 words, you really have to make your points as concisely but as interestingly as possible. You still have to give yourself enough time and space to develop a point, but you also can't waffle, and you have to, you know, invariably these things, when you write a first draft, are twice as long as they need to be. So you have to cut a lot of stuff out. And that really kind of taught me the importance of self-editing and just cutting out so much stuff that is probably okay, you know, but it's sometimes it's just a slightly flowery description or something that you've put in brackets. You know, I always go back, if ever I have to do an edit, I always go and look at what I've put in brackets. They're always the first things to go because they're in brackets for a reason, you realize. But that made me think, okay, that could be the format for the book. If I can do all of these 50 something films in 1,000 words, then that, you know, based on what I've done for Empire, that surely is a great way of introducing people to these films, because the point is not to thoroughly dissect each film and say every single thing that can be said about these films. It's to highlight what I think is great about them and to introduce people to them and to encourage people to go and seek them out for themselves, or if they already know them, to go and do a bit more reading or just watch it again and think a bit more about what you've just seen.
And that creates a sort of democratic feel to the book as well, that you're not spending three times the amount of wordage on Psycho and Rear Window than you are on An Early Silent, for instance. And I think that gives you a new perspective into his career.
Yeah, I was very keen on that. You know, when I first started thinking about the book and what it was going to be, I was like, well, I don't, you know, I've read so much about Hitchcock, and almost every book you pick up will be really heavily weighted towards Psycho and Vertigo and Rear Window and those big ones. And it's so disappointing to read a really well-written book that just skips over the silence, barely touches on the British films apart from maybe The 39 Steps or The Lady Vanishes. And I just think, you know, that's not fair, because those films aren't widely seen enough. That some of them are not great, let's be honest, but every single one has got something in it that's worth investigating if you're interested in Hitchcock. And so I just wanted to give each one the same amount of attention.
And there is something about him being, you know, for better or worse, this auteur, that means that even his not great films, which frankly, you know, bookend his career, and even though they're not, say, his strongest films, they still have these fingerprints all over them that are interesting.
I mean, you can take his first and last films, The Pleasure Garden and Family Plot, and find all sorts of stuff in there that you would find in the bigger, more famous films. The Pleasure Garden opens with a shot of dancers coming down some steps, and you're focusing essentially on their legs. And then you cut to a shot of the audience that is watching these dancers, and it's a front row full of kind of lecherous old men with opera glasses. And boom, immediately voyeurism, you know, men ogling women, and it just moves on from there. And at some point in that film, there's a murder, and then the murder victim reappears in a kind of superimposition. She's not a ghost, but she is essentially a representation of the murderer's conscience. So he's using special effects there to kind of create a mood and enhance a character. And then skipping ahead to Family Plot, there's that amazing crane shot where the detective is kind of following, well, he's not a detective, he's a taxi driver, but he's a makeshift detective, but he's trying to follow somebody through a cemetery, and it's just like a really weird kind of maze thing that you're watching, and you just think, okay, well, this is, why is he doing that? And this is the thing with Hitchcock, he does all these things, and there's always a reason for it. He's not just showing off, he's trying to tell you something else. And I think in Family Plot, it's about coincidence and convergence, and about how kind of the meeting of two separate strands of a story or a life can just have kind of colossal consequences. He kind of does it that twice. There's the graveyard scene, which is probably not the best example of that. The better example of that is right at the beginning, when you've seen the first part of the story, and when Bruce Dern's taxi almost drives over a woman crossing the street, the picture then takes off her side of the story, and that's kind of where, and you think, wow, that's really okay. Then there's another huge crane shot, and you get, I'm waffling, but you get the idea. All of that going on through the whole oeuvre, if I'm allowed to use that slightly pretentious word.
Well, that's another thing. You don't really, you're really conscious in the book and the way it's written. You have this this great style, I think, that is a really easy read, but is also very funny. It's laced with lots of great jokes, but then they're not jokes for the sake of jokes. They go in with the observations as well. I mean, there's one that I picked out of Charles Laughton, Charles Laughton's character in Jamaica Inn, diving from the top of the mast and saying that doesn't exist in this film and that film, but maybe it should have done. That's such a
Charles Laughton's amazing. What did I watch him in recently? Oh, The Big Clock. It's a really mad film. Have you seen it?
Yeah, film noir, yeah.
Oh, yeah. But it's a film noir that kind of parodies film noir, and I'm not sure it realizes it's parodying film noir, but Charles Laughton's amazing in that.
One of the things that you do in the book, as well as the films, you also do these sort of intertitles, if you like, these chapters that go in between, where you discuss sort of other parts of Hitchology which overarch the filmography. So, for instance, you talk about his cameos, you talk about his collaborators, and that's a brilliant way, I think, of escaping that film by film thing
Yeah.
and zooming out, if I can use a cinematic
Sure.
analogy.
I track in and zoom. Yeah, I just didn't want it to be a long series of 1,000-word essays without any kind of anything breaking that up, because that would have been quite tedious to read. You just turn the page, oh, here's another one, here's another one, here's another one. So I think maybe you get about six or seven in a row, and then you get these little breaks in the middle. But they're all things that I felt are important to understand in understanding Hitchcock. The collaborators one is important because he, there's this whole argument over auteur theory, and he is one of the prime kind of suspects in that department, because there are so many people who will argue for him as an auteur. But there's no getting away from the fact that he did not make these films by himself. Yes, there are things in there that in all of his films that identify them as Hitchcockian, but without Robert Birx as his camera operator, or Bernard Herrmann doing some of those scores, or Edith Head doing some of those amazing costumes, or the unique things that Cary Grant brought to some films and that James Stewart brought to those films, and they couldn't have done the same things. Cary Grant could not always have done what James Stewart did, and vice versa. Same with Ingrid Bergman and Grace Kelly. I just wanted people to be aware of a bit more of an outside influence. And I'm not saying that I'm telling everyone these things for the first time, because they're not, everyone's Hitchcock is so studied, people know these things, but I just thought it would enhance the storytelling of the book to know about those things. And then the stuff like the cameos is kind of fun. The one thing that I was not really sure about whether it belonged in the book, but I decided to stick it in anyway, was a chapter about the Psycho sequels, which are obviously nothing to do with Hitchcock, but I thought there's an opportunity here to talk about what makes Hitchcock Hitchcockian if you are essentially doing something Hitchcockian, but it isn't quite working. Now, those films, they work in their own way, but they are undeniably and very obviously not Hitchcock. So I just thought that's a different way of working out what is Hitchcockian, not just by looking at what he did, but what somebody else did in his footsteps. And then there's a bit about Alma, his wife, which I couldn't leave out. I just think she's so important in that in his entire story. I can't remember the other ones I put in there, but it was just basically a way to kind of make it less boring.
It does give a sort of, this would definitely be one of those books that if somebody had read nothing about Hitchcock, you would say, well, this is where to start, because you get everything in that sense, whereas if you want to read the deeply into the biography, then there are several biographies, or if you
Yeah,
want to
of
read
course.
deeply into the theory, there's several stuff about
Yeah.
that as well.
No, I'd be very happy for this to be an introduction to Hitchcock for someone, because another thing that I was thinking about when I started was I just wanted to write something that I would have liked to have read when I first watched Vertigo. I would have liked to have picked up a book like this and just found out a bit more about what was going on in that film and what kind of surrounded it. And the book got reviewed by John Lias at Hey You Guys, and he said exactly the same thing. And I was just so pleased that he had picked up on that being a kind of a way into Hitchcock for someone if they wanted. But it's not entirely introductory. I think if you're very familiar with Hitchcock, I still hope there's new stuff in there. It's not new stuff that I have kind of discovered by raiding the Hitchcock vaults. It's just my approach and my opinions, which are, might be absolute dog shit, but they might make you think of something yourself.
No, absolutely not. I don't think there's I don't think I mean I have read the biographies. I have read the other stuff, and I read it and was utterly, I was by no means turning the pages and going, yeah, I know all this. Why is he telling me this? It was entertaining, it was fun, and it was, and there was stuff there I didn't know. So it's
Okay.
always interesting getting other people's perspectives and getting
Yeah,
that coming
absolutely.
in. I'm interested in what you said earlier about, looking at, someone who's doing a Hitchcock film who's not Hitchcock, and therefore, in terms of the Psycho sequels, for instance, and sort of working out the missing ingredients and defining him in that way. What do you see as the sort of the principal ingredients? I mean, there's some obsessions that, you say in one of the chapters that sort of key motifs that come again and again. But are there any sort of motifs that you think maybe are less well known? In, there's a flavor to him that you sort of catch, which I'm sort of thinking back to when you were talking about looking at film for the very first time as a student, sort of saying those indefinable bits that you sometimes find in movies.
Yeah, I mean, I think the great thing about Hitchcock is a lot of it is still indefinable. It's very ethereal and it's hard to put into words, which I think is why so many words have been written about him. But one thing that I did that I kind of clocked for the first time while writing this book was that I hadn't really seen anybody else talk about when they're talking about mothers or men on the run or any of those other very familiar Hitchcockian tropes, blondes or whatever. Is that there are so many films with a kind of unhappy or antagonistic male-female relationship. It's usually a marriage, or it's between a man and a woman who are together but not married. And I just found it fascinating that there was so much of that in Hitchcock. Now, I know that a lot of films, especially romantic comedies and anything made in Hollywood in the kind of mid-20th century, is kind of predicated on people not getting on with each other so that they can fall in love. But just in Hitchcock, it just seemed to drive so much of the narrative. There just seemed to be so many, even minor background characters, like, well, Joss Merlyn in Jamaica Inn, for example, is not a minor character, but his relationship with his wife is awful. And there's loads of it in the 39 Steps. There's the show at the beginning at the Palladium. Well, it's not the Palladium at the beginning, it's the music hall. But there's like an old married couple, and he wants to know what causes Pippin poultry. And he's just getting kind of battered by his wife for asking silly questions. And there's stuff like that all the way through. And I couldn't quite get to the bottom of why this was, because his relationship with Alma was really interesting. They stayed together their entire lives. You know, they got together very young, they got married, and they were together. When she, the point being, they stayed together for such a long time. So something worked in that marriage. And yet, you read all these stories. I mean, if you read anything that Donald Spoto wrote about Hitchcock, you will get all the kind of sordid details about his kind of lust for his leading ladies, always unrequited, as far as I'm aware. And you know that Alma knew about this, and she just put up with so much of his shit for so long. And I just think that he just saw partnerships between a man and a woman as just impossible, because there would always be a temptation to stray. And I think that informs quite a lot of his stories. But I always, you know, we'll never know really what went on in their marriage to some extent. But I think there are some very interesting comparisons and contrasts to be drawn.
Yeah, it's like the sort of skepticism that human relationships will ever work. It's just like either you're locked together or.
Yeah, it's like it's like a kind of criticism of monogamy. Like, it's just a stupid concept that can't possibly work. But you know, invariably he will bring his characters together at the end and pack them off. But also, a lot of the time, there's just a little bit of cynicism about it. There's a little bit of a hint, like at the end of Rear Window, for example. You do feel like there's finally, after all this bickering between Jimmy Stewart and Grace Kelly, that there is some. They've come together and they've reached a kind of happy conclusion, but then Hitchcock reveals that she wasn't reading the magazine about going off and whatever it is. She's reading something that implies that she hasn't actually changed her point of view at all, despite the fact that the whole film has been leading towards her and him coming to some kind of compromise. So I think there's a lot of that. You know, a lot of the endings seem happy, but if you look at them a bit more closely, they're not that happy.
It's always interesting, and you sort of brought this up earlier in your answer when you're talking about the Spoto biography. I always think there's a little bit, he gets a little bit of a hard time. I mean, he behaved atrociously, and there's no doubt about that. But there's also, I think, not but, and that's better. And there's also something kind of unforgiving about the fact that you look at this guy who is not particularly prepossessing physically, and he's working on a daily basis with some of these absolutely beautiful people, both male and female. So there is a kind of, there is a human tragedy there of sorts, of like the, I mean, he's standing next to Cary Grant as he directs him towards Ingrid Bergman. And you make the point in the book that the Cary Grant character, to some degree, in Notorious, could stand as an avatar for Hitchcock himself, and quite a tragic one in that sense.
I mean, I'm not going to go into tons of detail about like that kind of psychology of Hitchcock because people have done that a lot better. But there is definitely a sense of a tragic person who is quite shy and very self-aware that he doesn't look like Cary Grant. And I think that.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Also informs a lot that happens in his films, you know, for good and ill. I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of women get a tough deal in some of his films, especially later on when, you know, he gets slightly more corpulent and I hesitate to use the words less attractive, but you know, he's getting on and he's he's not in his prime. But also Alma has kind of stepped away from her involvement in the films towards the end of his career. She's still there kind of in the background, but she's not doing as much as she used to. And that's when the women seem to get a bit of a rougher ride, particularly Frenzy. It's just unspeakable behavior going on to me. But I think kind of comes from his psychology. So yeah, there's tons of that in there. That's the kind of thing that I wanted to hint towards in the book, but I don't think I'm quite qualified to kind of comment on it in any great psychological depth.
I don't want to ask your favorite Hitchcock film because of a guy who's made so many Hitchcock movies. A guy's made so many Hitchcock movies. He's made so
that would
many.
Be Alfred Hitchcock.
Yeah, that's him. It's like there's a clue in the title. A guy's made so many movies, it's a nonsense question. But I do want to sort of get a flavor for. Well, actually, here's another one. Here's a different sort of question. In writing the book, was there a sort of film that popped up? And you reassessed as in the process of writing the book?
That is a good question. Almost certainly that happened. Oh, The Ring. So there's a silent film called The Ring, 1927, which I'd seen loads of times before and just never really got a lot out of. But this is what happens when you set yourself the task of really investigating a film and especially then writing about it, is you just find more stuff in there. And that film became, I suddenly realized that there was absolutely tons of great stuff in there, loads of really clever visual metaphors, loads of motifs, and also just a kind of really great story that I for some reason had just more or less dismissed in the past. I don't know why. The second version of The Man Who Knew Too Much, I'd never really got on with very well, and I still don't think it's as good as the first one, but I did find a lot of very interesting stuff in there about kind of gender politics in the arena of marriage, because Jimmy Stewart's character is a total prick in that film, and you know, Doris Day is doing all the work. And for some reason, that was just never really apparent to me until I watched it this time, with kind of X number of films behind me and thinking about what had gone into them. So yeah, this is the great film. The great thing about studying film is just finding more stuff each time you watch something. So you're not just watching a thing that you've watched before and wasting 2 hours. You're watching in a totally different way from different mindset, especially if you're older, which obviously you would be if you're watching it for a second time, unless you've gone back in time, which is unlikely.
It's just, I love the way we're both tying ourselves in knots with some of these.
Yeah. It's like, I really wish you'd just stop me before I get that far.
No, I'm fine. I'm enjoying it.
I can see you've got the popcorn there.
I want revenge for the Hitchcock, the guy who made the Hitchcock films. Which of those?
We're even.
The Doris Day character is really interesting as well, because it goes back to what we're saying about relationships, because she is, you know, almost like her filmography is made almost entirely of navigating and defining the American monogamous relationship in the 50s and 60s. You know, it's that, you know, all those films she did with Rock Hudson and Pillow Talk and things like that. It seems her... almost like her, she's a genre in herself in that sense. And then putting her with Jimmy Stewart and making him such a rat.
I think that's something that Hitchcock just really enjoyed doing, was taking stars with a recognizable persona and just giving them something to do that you hadn't really seen them do before. And, you know, to get Jimmy Stewart, and he's another one, you know, to take him with his star persona and everything that he'd built up over the years, and marry him off to Doris Day, and then make him drug her before telling her that their son has been kidnapped. It's like, why would you? That's awful. You know, what are you doing to these beloved actors that, you know, America's sweethearts? It's just atrocious. But it's not, of course. It's brilliant, because it just stretches them and it makes you just think about things.
Absolutely. There were so many actors who work with him who their careers, already huge careers, James Stewart had been acting since the 30s, 40s, and similarly Cary Grant. And yet you have some of their best work is with Hitchcock. And that's true of so many actors. And again, as I say, it's actors who have done great work with other people. It's not they're just a one-hit wonder with Hitchcock, but Ingrid Bergman and Eva Marie Saint, and, you know, absolutely Gene Kelly.
I'm not saying anything.
No, I'm going to go on. Instead of correcting myself, I'm going to try and work out.
Double down.
Yeah, 50 films. There must be one with Gene Kelly.
Yeah, he was in Psycho, I think.
Yeah. He was the plug hole. Singing Down the Drain. Oh, dear.
Oh, very good.
Oh, was that
a
catch?
There you go. It's worth it. Yeah, you dug yourself out of that hole, Wilson.
I do love a fact from Psycho, which I think I wrote a whole article about once, which is I wrote an article for, I'm not sure if it's still alive, but a blog called Electric Sheep. It's called Electric Sheep Magazine. It used to be a physical magazine. It became a blog. And I did one on toilets in cinema. And it started with the fact that the one problem that they had getting Psycho past the censors was the shot of the flushing toilet.
I know. It's incredible, isn't it? To think that you couldn't show a flushing toilet.
And apparently Hitchcock put a flushing toilet in, or the sound of a flushing toilet, in almost all of his films.
Are you sure? I have not heard that.
Except for the silence.
Okay. I'm going to go and watch them all again and listen out for that. Because if that's true, that's amazing.
If that's too true, that's a second edition, revised edition.
Hitchology, the toilet edition. Number two.
Of those sort of, those giant films, those sort of like the if you like, the canon of Hitchology. Mm. I mean, the title of your book, Hitchology, made me sort of, I was thinking, okay, this is an academic discipline now. This has become something bigger than simply somebody's filmography. This is a whole, it's a philosophy, an ideology.
Mm.
So I was thinking, so if that's true, then there must be sort of like the first semester films that you have to have these in your Hitchcock 101. So yeah. what of those films do you think are the sort of the essentials for someone who maybe isn't au fait with the oeuvre?
It's interesting that you should ask, because on page 7 of the book is the chapter The Essential 10. So I've selected 10 films which I wanted to say, if you haven't seen any Hitchcock, or if you've only seen a few, if you just want to get a really good overview of his entire career and not just see Psycho and Vertigo and Rear Window and North by Northwest, I mean, they're all in there, but I kind of separated out all his films. So I looked at what percentage of his films were British and what were American, what was silent, what was sound, what was black and white, what was color, what were thrillers and what were dramas. And then I tried to make a list that fairly represented all of those things. So I started with doing it in chronological order. The Lodger was the first one, because I hope you are going to edit some of this, because I don't know what the answer to the because is.
This is the Ivan Novello starring sort of Jack the Ripper.
Yeah, I just thought I felt myself launching into a kind of explanation of 10 films, and I don't need to do that. But in the book, basically, is my short list of 10 films that will kind of give you Hitchcock in a nutshell. And right. Then if you want to go on any further, you can. If you don't, that's absolutely fine with me.
Okay, let's narrow it down then. If you wanted to give the most Hitchcockian movie of his, what would that be, do you think?
That would have to be North by Northwest.
Right.
I think just because it's got everything. It's got Bernard Herrmann's music, it's got Cary Grant, it's got an icy cool blonde, it's got a charming villain, it's an amazing thriller, it's got incredible camera work, things in there that just leap out at you, like we were saying before, stuff that seems really odd, like the sudden cut to an extreme top shot from the United Nations building in New York of Cary Grant running out the door. Like, you think, why has he done that? And I tried to explain why I think he did it in the book. You might have a different interpretation of it, but you know, that film is full of all that stuff. And I just, it's also the kind of, what's the word I'm looking for, where something is like an apogee maybe, or a zenith, I don't know. But he had his Wrong Man on the Run thrillers, which kind of the first great one that he made was The 39 Steps. He virtually remade with Saboteur, and then virtually remade again with North by Northwest. And they all stand up in their own right, those films. But I think it's like he wanted to get it right. He kept doing it because he wanted to make it really, really good. And I think that's what happened with North by Northwest. He just absolutely perfected this thing that he kind of tinkering away at for most career.
And there is this odd thing that he does in his career as well, where he has a sort of genre view of certain things, like The Wrong Man on the Run. And then he also makes a film that is like, takes that in less of a caper direction. I'm thinking of the is it just called The Wrong Man with Henry Fonda?
Yeah, yeah, that's a good one.
In which it is like, yeah, what if this actually happens in not Hitchcock universe, but in the real the real world? And it's
that's fair.
I mean, that's a really fine. So a former guest of Writers on Film, Jason Izranovitz, wrote a really good book called Nothing to Fear, which was a sort of, you know, concentrated entirely on the film, but also on the real life case which inspired the film. And he argued that it was sort of unique in Hitchcock's filmography as his only sort of social justice, sort of true story film. But I sort of think he sort of does that occasionally with, so for instance, also in terms of his Icy Blonde, and then he'll do a film like, say, Marnie, in which is much more troubled and much more, it's almost like he's taking that and saying, well, but what are the real world consequences of some of these weird ideas that I have?
Yeah, I mean, The Wrong Man is a really good example of that. It's probably not the only one that's based on a true story. I think Rope is based on a true story.
Oh,
well, it's based
course,
on a play that was based on a true story. But I mean, he absolutely turns that into entertainment. Whereas The Wrong Man is quite a difficult watch. It's quite a downbeat and slightly depressing film with this kind of, apart from the very tacked on ending, which is not entirely true to life. But yeah, that's a good point. Like he did take his wrong man theory, called the film that, and then made something very un-Hitchcockian about it. Although you will find obviously loads of obvious Hitchcockian examples. But yeah, that's a really interesting film for a lot of reasons. I talk about this in the book, but it's quite heavily about the immigrant experience, I think, in America. Mm. That like most of the characters are not they're not Americans, or they're maybe first or second generation immigrants to America, which I find really interesting. There's something in there about society wanting to point the finger at a specific type of person when a crime happens or when a thing happens, which you can extrapolate to the whole world. At any point throughout history, you can see it now everywhere. So that kind of thing like happens all the time.
Yeah, and it's one of the you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, because I very much might be, isn't it sort of one of his only films to sort of really have a lot of a real religious feeling to it, in the sense of there's actually moments where the character prays and then he's released, and there's a sort of, it feels like there might be a God in this universe, whereas in other even films where he has priests and I confess and things like that,
yeah,
it's you know, they dress as priests and they do that, but there's no intimation that there's actually something to be taken seriously.
I mean, that's fair in The Wrong Man, because Henry Fonda's character prays, and coincidentally or not, something happens after that is good for him. I Confess is an interesting one because obviously it's about a priest. But I think he's less interested in religion per se, and more interested in the concept of guilt, and particularly transference of guilt. And so there's tons of that in all the films. I mean, transference of guilt is there, you know, in The Wrong Man, it's someone has committed a crime and somebody else is blamed for it. And that in every Wrong Man thriller that Hitchcock made, there's that. So there's elements of kind of Catholic guilt going on all over the place, but yeah, I think you're probably right to say that The Wrong Man is the only one where religion gets a kind of funky look in.
Yeah, and that's it's also interesting in terms of, I Confess, that the I remember reading one of the crueler stories about Hitchcock, meeting Montgomery Clift, who was, you know, had huge issues with alcohol. And also with his own self-esteem as an actor and everything like that. And he went for dinner with Alma and Hitchcock, and Hitchcock basically kept serving him brandies after brandy.
What a great guy.
Knowing full well, and, you know, you drink up, my boy. And and just, you know, it's kind of like just unforgivable in many ways, that sort of manipulation.
Yeah, I mean, you can't get away from the fact that he was an amazing and brilliant director, but potentially not, there's no potentially about it. He just wasn't a great person. I don't think you would, you know, when people say, who would your fantasy dinner guests be? There is a temptation to say Hitchcock, but I honestly think he would just absolutely ruin it. He'd just ruin a dinner by being really rude. He'd fall asleep. He'd insult everybody. And yeah, he would make fun of people's alcoholism or whatever else they brought literally to the table.
Any weakness. Yeah. Actually, I've got a better game then. The nightmare dinner, the dinner for your enemy. I would invite Peter Sellers.
Okay. Yeah, fair.
Peter Sellers and Alfred Hitchcock would be two invitations.
Yeah, I'm not going to go down this road because I'll end up upsetting somebody. But yeah, be awful. But I think this is important with Hitchcock. I think it's really important to recognize and to discuss the whole art, not versus, but the art, separating the art from the artist. And you know, so much of that has gone on throughout the cinema industry, still going on. And you know, you can't get away from it. And it would be great if everybody was nice all the time, but you wouldn't get these kind of troubled and in psychologically interesting works of art. And you know, is it worth it? I probably not, But I don't know. That's another huge conversation that I'm not about to get into because I don't have the answers.
Looking at figures who, from the point of view of their personal lives, have done terrible things.
Mm.
It's difficult to separate from their work because you sometimes think those terrible things have informed how they've actually, what their obsessions are.
Yes, 100%. It's what has made some of those films so interesting.
You know, I mean, I think you can watch things without necessarily giving approval to retrospectively.
Yeah,
as long as you acknowledge it. That's where I think I would stand, although I don't have the confidence of my own opinions.
No, I think we're both kind of chickening out of saying anything definitive, aren't we? But I mean, this is what I wanted to do with the book. There's a chapter in there about the trouble with Hitchcock, and I very, very briefly talk about why he was not necessarily a great guy. And I think that it's just... you know, you can read a biography and you will get all of this stuff, but sometimes if you're just reading a film guide to his films, you might not get that sense. And I think it's an important thing to understand, especially if you're going to be one of those people who picks up this as your first Hitchcock book. My first Hitchcock, you know, I think you need to be aware of it from the beginning. So it's important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's important from more than just a sort of prurient interest in the private lives of others. But I don't think you could understand The Birds and you can understand Marnie and you can understand Frenzy without that. I mean, you could watch those films and you would intuit that there's something going on here. This guy has some issues.
Sure. That is a way of putting it.
And on that bombshell, I would love to, you know, continue digging this hole, but I've decided that my arms are tired.
Step away from the hole.
I'm stepping away from the hole. I feel like I haven't asked enough questions in a way, because I feel like there's so much to talk about with Hitchcock and it's almost, you almost become baffled in front of him. I mean, I think that's the genius of the book, actually, is by getting this structure and imposing the structure, which is a very Hitchcocking thing, isn't it? You know, he has this, you know, he's interested in like limiting himself. You know, it's like rope. I'm going to do this all in one go.
Or lifeboat. Yeah, all those things. Yeah, exactly. Yes, I am essentially Alfred Hitchcock in the way I wrote this book. Thank you for the comparison. I appreciate it.
See, that's exactly what I was going on to say. That's exactly it. That's exactly it. And do you have a cameo in the book?
Well, my name is in it somewhere. Oh, here it is. It's on the front cover. It's not really a cameo.
No,
should have done that, though.
Just had a little sort of flick at the bottom, in the bottom corner.
I should have done an acrostic. I should have done an acrostic in one of the chapters where the first letter of each paragraph spelled out my name.
There you go. You see.
Maybe I did do that, and I'm double bluffing you. I didn't do that.
Revised, second edition, revised and updated.
Yeah, that'll be in the toilet flushing edition.
Brilliant. Right, one last question then, Neil.
Okay.
Film book recommendation.
Does it have to be? Can it be a Hitchcock book, or can it be anything? What are you after?
Can be anything. Okay. Can be anything, and it can be more than one because that's what.
Maybe I'll answer both of those questions then. So, if I was going to recommend a Hitchcock book to anyone apart from my own, obviously, then Hitchcock Truffaut is the Bible, I think, because Hitchcock was never afraid to talk about his work, his own work, and what things meant. You know, a lot of writers and directors would rather the audience kind of worked it out for themselves or brought their own interpretation to it, but Hitchcock was very open about that stuff, but he was also full of shit quite a lot of the time, and you get this in Hitchcock Truffaut, because Truffaut, you know, he asked some really great questions throughout that book, throughout those interviews, but he was a little bit potentially naive and a bit starstruck, and you get that sense as you're reading it, and Hitchcock kind of handles him in that way. You know, he kind of takes charge of the interviews. But so, you know, it's a really interesting read in terms of Hitchcock as a person and his relationship with Truffaut and vice versa. But also he just talks and talks and talks and talks and talks about his films. And that's really, really interesting to anybody who's interested in his films. So that would be my go-to. That was always, every time I watched a film, I would always pick up that book first and see what he was saying about that book, because every other book that I picked up afterwards would be quoting from Hitchcock Truffaut at some point. So that would be my Hitchcock go-to. In terms of film books generally, I would like to pay tribute to the recently deceased David Bordwell, American film scholar who just died, and his book, which he wrote with Christine Thompson, Film Art, An Introduction, which I was told to buy. I did my level film studies, and I bought the fourth edition of it, and I still have that book, and I still refer to it, and I think they're now on the 12th edition. So my fourth edition is woefully out of date, because it was kind of before CG really took off. I guess Jurassic Park had happened and Terminator 2 had happened, but you know, so much has happened since then. So if you're interested in why films look and sound the way they do, how they're edited, what all of that means, how writers and directors and filmmakers bring meaning through style, that book is just an amazing way of learning all that stuff. And it just doesn't just cover Hollywood. It covers, you know, the whole world and the whole history. That's fantastic. And David Bordwell is a great loss.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that book has been, and him as a writer has been cited several times on this podcast, as you can imagine.
Okay.
And he was even going to come on for Perplexing Plots, which turned out to be his last, which is a brilliant book, which is all about difficult, complicated plots in films and noirs and Pulp Fiction, he uses as an example. Just one of those intellects which embraced popular culture seriously and serious culture popularly, if that's a thing.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Excellently put.
Fantastic, Neil. I really enjoyed the book. Hitchology is out there now for available from, I'll put a link to in the show notes. But thanks so much for taking the time to come and talk to me.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me. I would just say, if anybody wants to kind of try before they buy, then Amazon has that look inside feature. You can read the first few pages and decide if my style is for you or not. It's entirely possible that it's not. I don't know. By the time this comes out, it might be there, but there's the Empire Online website are going to put an extract from the book up there at some point. So that's either there by now or is shortly arriving. So, you know, you can have a free taster and then decide whether you want to splash out on the whole thing. But thank you for the chance to plug it and sell another copy or two.
Another copy or two? I think you severely overestimate the impact of this podcast. Another copy.
Okay, fine. I still appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Neil.
Thank you, John.